we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I'm your host, Amber, and I am here today with author and artist Jamin Still, who is back for round two with us. Welcome back, Jamin.
Thank you. Really excited to be here. Looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, we're excited. So last time when you were here, we talked about your art and your life as a reader and your writing at that time of your first novel. And since then, you have published your first novel, The Master of Tides, and that is super exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. That was, did we speak last summer? Was it 9, 10 months ago?
At least.
Okay. Yeah. I think it was obviously before the book was out, but it was, mm-hmm. it was coming. And so, yeah, being on the other side of that, there's a lot of relief. Prepping a book is huge, as you know, and getting it out was super exciting, and I'm glad it's out there.
That is exciting. Could you give, I know you talked about it in the last episode, which we encourage mm-hmm. people to go listen to if they missed, but could you just give us a synopsis of this world and series that you've built in Hibaria, and let our readers know a little bit about the book that came out?
Sure. The world came about through my paintings. So I've been painting for a long time. I've been painting since high school. And I've been painting this world since, I'm guessing, about 2009, 2010. So it's been a number of years. I didn't really know I was painting the world at first. But over that time, it's been slowly developing where there are there's a certain aesthetic feel to it, landscape, characters, a lot of animals, a lot of kids, a lot of mystery. And it was probably about 8 or 9 years ago that I actually started to think about what became this book. And so the interactions that happen in this book between these kids. It is primarily about kids, simply because that's what I painted a lot. And so that was my building blocks were there.
You had a cast.
yeah, the cast was there. And then all these creatures, basically the last 8 or 9 years has been me figuring out why I was painting these things and kind of how they relate to one another. And so it's a fantasy world. It is, like I said, really mysterious, fantastical, magical, filled with wonder. I think painting children, if you want to get really psychological about it, I was probably painting myself as a kid or mm-hmm. a version of that, kind of processing my own experience with wonder and awe and the questions I've had and just kind of making those into stories. So that's kind of a loose setting for the world. Do you want me to get more specific or?
No, I think that's great for the world. Do you want to tell us a little bit specifically about The Master of Tides?
Sure. So The Master of Tides builds on some short stories that I released in 2020. I put out a kind of a large illustrated book of short stories in 2020. There was 12 of them. And each of these short stories had a different character or set of characters, and they were each interacting with a different constellation, which in my world are all animals, and they can come down from the sky and kind of take form. And they talk to kids, surprisingly, because that's what I paint. And so they have these conversations with these kids. And so those 12 stories kind of set the table for this novel, in that it introduces this storyline. It kind of creates these characters that are in some way going to affect the storyline. And so this book is some of those characters, as well as a new character, Cora. And it dives right into it in detail. And so it's kind of a quest story where she heads off to find this thing that has been stolen. And she has adventures along the way, meets friends. There are great, or I hope, relationships that form that are really fun to kind of explore and write.
Yeah.
And then a lot of cool magic stuff along the way, and then a bad guy that they kind of do battle with. And so this was the first novel I had written. It was, man, so hard, but really satisfying too, because this is what I'd read as a kid, and it's really cool to be able to sit down and kind of explore the things that I really liked as I was reading and try to recreate that for someone else.
Yeah, I think that's great, being able to recreate more of what you loved as a kid and bring that to another generation. So when we did speak last year, you were mid-writing. I think you were getting ready to send it to an editor. And so now in retrospect, how do you feel the whole writing process went? And my question is, how did you know you were done? That's always something that
That's
my kids
question.
Are struggling with their books, is especially with a series, is where do you end and plan for the next one to pick up?
Well, the first part of the question, the whole process, man, it's hard. It is really hard to, I think it's hard to just to do it all. It's hard to write something that you really are in love with and then kind of tear it apart. I think there has to be some attempt at objectivity in your editing process, where you're just willing to be really brutal. You can love your characters or love your storyline to your detriment. And by that, I mean, if you're not willing to make some changes that make a better story, you get to keep your cool scene or your cool character doing a certain thing. But if you're not able to step back and see, hey, this doesn't actually serve what I'm trying to do, then it's not as good. And it's one thing to hear that, and I've heard that a lot. You got to kill your darlings is the saying. And if you're not willing to, it's tough. It's one thing to hear that though, and then another thing to do it. Mm-hmm. And so that was a process through the couple rounds of editing that were painful to actually execute, to make some changes. So for me, there was a lot of self-editing in the first few years of writing it. Mm-hmm. And then when the editor came in, there was like that external kind of advice and well, here's why, like usually good, very good reasons. And then my decision to either say yes or no, because ultimately it was kind of up to me. Mm-hmm. But there were some cases where I could see the wisdom and what was being said, even though it was painful. Yeah. Fortunately, in that it took so long to write, time itself really helps. If I set it aside for a month or two, which I did several times, and then come back to it, it's easier to be more objective and kind of make those changes.
And when you're still immersed.
Yeah. The how do you know when you're finished part, it's just so hard because you can always improve something. You can always, and I've run into this with painting too. How do you know when a painting's
done?
That
would be similar, right?
Yeah, no. And so I've had a lot of practice with painting, and usually the answer to that is just need. It needs to be done because I need to work on the next one, whether it's a commission that has a deadline or whether it's I have a show and I need more paintings. And so with painting, I've come to a place where I know it's not perfect, and I try to, whenever I look at a finished piece that's not great or in my mind not as good as it could be, I do say I'll do that particular thing better next time. And so I just use it as motivation, and I can see over time how I've overall gotten better. And so I think with that tool in place, it's easier to kind of trust that that's true with writing too, even though it feels super exposing. I'm going to put this thing out there. I know it could be better, but like, and people are going to, all that stuff goes through your head. Like people are going to point out, either a hole in the plot or bad writing or repetitive words or whatever.
Yeah.
And I know that's there, but like, if I can't say, so be it, maybe I'll get a little bit better at it next time, I'll never be done.
Right.
And so it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to actually
to do it.
Put it out there. Yeah. And that's not a satisfying answer at all, because it's...
I think it's a good answer, though. It's an honest one. And
yeah.
And it is part of the process. And we do see authors grow so much from book one in series to book two to book three. And I always tell people, when there's a series that's really popular and they're like, oh, we tried to read book one and we just, you know, found all these different problems with it. It's like, okay, but very often that's the freshman offering from that author. And if you give them a little bit of time to hit their groove and to learn, you'll be really, really pleased by the last book or even by the second book so often.
No, that's true. And it's, I think if that is your first book, the first in a series, and if you care very much about what people think about you as the author, you just got to get over that. I'm someone who really wants to be seen as competent, and so that kind of perfectionism has really kept me back in a lot of ways. This, I mean, with this project, it's like, I know it's not going to be perfect, and I know people are going to be able to point at certain things, and that kind of hurts. That kind of like, it kind of offends my sense of like, I want to be a pro, but like at the same time, I know it's inevitable, and I just need to kind of let that go.
Yeah.
And you're right. And hopefully the second book, will kind of be affected by what was learned in the first. I'm hoping that's the case with me for sure. And, I think it's kind of inevitable because writing a novel is just ridiculously hard. You're like juggling all these things, and whether it's terrible or not, you learn a little something in doing it. And so when you do it again, I do think that ends up coming through in some ways.
Yeah. So. I think that I've had this beautiful position with my daughters and their writing to be able to learn about the world building process. And I really appreciate watching them see the holes in their methods. So last night they were talking about the fact that because they both talk about this one book that Inara is writing so much, that Gemma is now disqualified as a beta reader that can actually point out if there's missing information that a reader would need, because they've had so many outside the book conversations about this world that neither of them can now identify. Does everybody else already know this, or did we forget to put it in the book? And
that's a pretty amazing kind of realization.
Yeah.
Like that they're self-aware enough of that.
Yeah.
So they got to find another beta.
Yeah. That's what I told them. They're like, oh man, we got to bring more people in. It's like, yes, make your group bigger. It'll be good. So I love that. But the reviews are in for your book, Jamin. And I know that you do the very wise thing for your own mental health of not reading all the reviews people write, but I do. And they're very good.
I absolutely don't, because a good review, I guess, is good. I think as an author, I dismiss a good review and I take to heart a bad review, which is so messed up.
Yeah.
But it's what I do. So I'm like, I'm just not going to read these. And
they're all positive that I've read. And there was one that I would say was neutral, because all it said was, where's the next book? And
that's going to quickly become negative. I guess that's a neutral positive, because if they want the next book,
exactly.
I guess that was positive. Oh, the pressure.
Yes. But on that theme, how many books can the readers expect from this series when it's completed? Like, do you have a storyboard of that level in mind, or just a ballpark?
I think the ballpark is 3 to 4. And those are of novel length stories. There may be room for smaller
novellas slipped in between.
Little novellas. I don't know. I haven't quite settled on how that would look, but the main story would be 3 or 4. I know where this second one ends, and
nice.
It's exciting to have the next book very roughly mapped out. but it makes me think maybe four instead of three, which was my original kind of trilogy idea.
Yeah. So that's great. I don't think I was really familiar with the concept of putting novellas into book series. It wasn't really a thing when I was a kid. Like, that wasn't the way the book series I read were. They all were like the same size book until S.D. Smith started doing it with the Green Ember series. And so those were like what I considered to be novella length. And then sometimes authors will give away or like do 99-cent novellas to like promote their series on Kindle. And those are all like the same length as Sam's book. So that's what I thought novellas were until we wander into like the world of Brandon Sanderson, where like his actual
novels. What are novels, his novellas? Like 80,000?
They're a novel. They are like the normal novel size because his normal novels are tomes. And so it's so funny because his Skyward series has this novella series within it that is actually necessary to the series. Whereas like S.D. Smith's books, you can just read the Green Ember series and you'll have the full story. And then the novellas just are like side quests. But for
They're kind of like appendices. At least what I would do if I do novellas, it would be like, man, I really want to write this. It's not vital, but it would be really cool. And so it's something you use to stick in an appendix, maybe.
Which is great. And then Brandon Sanderson's, like, he has his tomes that are all following Spence's viewpoint, and then each of these novellas follows like another character's viewpoint, but they're off doing their own thing that's absolutely necessary to the story for history and concept building. And so if you don't read those and you get to the last book, you're like, what is going on?
so they are kind of vital.
Yeah, they're absolutely vital. So I usually skip novellas as thinking that they're just, you know, extras. And I happened to have been listening to these because I had a long car trip by myself for a funeral. And so I was like listening to the novellas and I was like, I need to know this. Like, this is really important stuff. I'm glad I listened to them. So yeah, but I'm looking forward to anything that comes out for the world of Hibaria. So now that your first book in the series is published, how does it feel to see your work out in the world? And have there been any unexpected challenges or rewarding moments along the way with that whole launching of that child?
It's cool. It's cool and scary. As I mentioned earlier, the scary part of putting it out there and kind of it's set in stone. Like, I can't go and edit it anymore. And so that is intimidating. It's also cool in that it is, wow, it's on Amazon. It's a real thing. Amazon tries to sell it to me. I get emails constantly. Hey, have you, we think you'd like this. Have you bought The Master of Tides? I get it for both the audio and the Kindle and the print book. And so that's amusing. But yeah, I mean, I also get ads for real books out there. And so it's cool to kind of be in that category and that it's on that platform and it's available. I think, talking to people who've read it, so there's categories of people. I think that sounds really terrible. So there's people who are more, how do I say it? More, I don't want to say more perceptive, but like readers who are looking for themes, who are in some ways concerned about the things that I was concerned about, like, does this arc work? Do these characters work? Are these two characters too similar to each other? Those kinds of things where they're able to enter in knowing that this is my first novel and kind of discuss, those things that the author who's writing the novel is probably going to be thinking about, maybe worried about, hoping turn out in a certain way. And so I've got a few friends who are in that category, and those conversations have been both encouraging and what's the other one? I guess it's just encouraging. They've been good.
Yeah.
I think they've also been constructive too. It's not like they just tell me the good things. or what I want to hear.
That's
but that's been really, really satisfying. I do think it just takes time for people to read it, you know?
Yeah.
I think as an author, you hope or expect people to read it whenever they get it. But like, as a person, I'm like, I don't do that when
right.
I get books. Like sometimes I do. I mean, there's a few that fall in that category, but sometimes it takes me 6 months to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so being patient for that too, knowing that not everyone's going to read it immediately. Just the other day, a friend messaged me and said, "Hey, I finished it. This was great." And my initial was, "Wow, it took you that long?" But then it's like, "Wow, no, you actually took time to read it. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you're responding so positively." And so that's been super encouraging and helping me to reset my expectations at the same time.
Yeah, that's good awareness to have. I want the listeners to know that the book just released on audiobook, and the reader is amazing. And I think I would listen to her just like read a cookbook. And she's so good. But before the audiobook was out, Gemma didn't want to wait that long. And Gemma's dyslexic. And so she does a lot of audiobooks where she just reads along with the book. And so she just redid Jonathan Rogers' Wilder King trilogy. And I want to brag on my kids right now because they are like really self-aware people. And sometimes they actually listen to what I say, which I really appreciate, because I've been telling Gemma that part of why Inara is a stronger writer than her, besides being 3 years older, is the fact that Inara's read more than her. And that Inara is more familiar with story structure from that and character development. And so Gemma, at the new year, she was like, "I've decided I'm not going to work on writing my books anymore until I've read 5 more books." And she did it. She ended, like, it took her a couple months. She ended last week, and then she's just been writing nonstop since. But I was so proud of her as a 14-year-old to just have that level of self-awareness that she needed to grow stronger in this area. And then she went and picked the books, and some of the books she picked was the Wilder King trilogy. But another book that she picked was, she really wanted to finish The Master of Tides, because she had started it and then put it aside when she heard there was going to be an audiobook, because she was like, "I'll just wait for that." But then she was like, "I'm not going to wait. I want to finish it." And it was painstaking for her to get through it, just because it, you know, it's 5 times harder for her than anybody else. And she didn't complain about it. She didn't do it. Like, she just enjoyed the story and she just kept reading it. And it was a few pages here, a few pages there. And she got through it and she really enjoyed it. And she is excited for the next book. And then she's also excited. Inara has not read it yet. And Inara is waiting for the audiobook so it can be one of our car books that we listen to. And Gemma's like, "I'm jumping in on that car book again." So,
gotcha. Oh, that's cool.
But I love the fact that she was like, "I need to step back and I need to put more good stories in me in order to be able to tell good stories."
It's what's really cool about that is I totally agree. You end up being able to write better based on what you read, not based on what you read, but because you read.
Yeah.
And it just kind of intuitively seeps in.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's funny, when you do write, you become aware, or at least I did, I become aware of areas of weakness, let's say, or at least areas where I wish I could be better, which I guess is weakness. So for example, let's just say with dialogue, you struggle with, it just sounds, blah, 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 said Cora, blah, 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 said Will.
Mm-hmm.
If you read and you're kind of aware of that with certain authors where they kind of repeat the word said, that can really get on your nerves. And so if you're an author and you don't know how to not do that, and you really understand that this is an area of your struggle, having written, and you keep bumping up against that, to then go and read someone else and be specifically looking for how
right.
they handle those same areas that maybe are weak for you is yeah. just amazingly helpful. Yeah. And I think there's been a couple of cases of that for me since writing my book. Mm-hmm. Not the said thing, but there's other examples that aren't immediately coming to mind where I specifically am thinking like, man, how do they solve this? How do they mm-hmm. how do they address this kind of issue? And it's super neat because like this is your 14-year-old, but I'm still doing, I think we do this our whole lives and it makes us better. Whatever stage we're at in that. Yeah. So
we were neat. Talking on a drive the other day and there's a Facebook group for writers that I'm in, not because I'm writing, but because my daughters do. And so I like read through the posts and then I take tidbits back to them because they're not on social media to be like, oh, I read this and this was an interesting thought. What do you think? And so we can just, you know, explore ideas and interchange with them. And so I had come back and I was like, this person was saying that they had found a very popular New York Times bestseller that they had heard a ton of hype about. And so they decided to read one of the books to see what it was all about. And the book opens and there's this big room, or there's a room where a council is meeting, and they get to the end of the chapter and they were just like, wait a minute, I still don't know how big this room is. I don't know what the table is made out of. I don't know any of the, I don't know what people were wearing. Like, I can't visualize this. And it's, and so then we started talking about how that would affect scene setting for moving forward in the story. And I was like, well, you know, if the table is metal, what are you going to assume? And they're like, well, it's probably sci-fi or set in like a metal guild. And it's like, right. And if it's like 4-inch thick slab of wood that you can feel ridges in, they're like, oh yeah, this stuff does matter. And then talking about different, you know, clothing designs, letting you know about different people groups. And it was a really good conversation, but I enjoy watching them learn more about scenery setting.
Yeah, that's super important.
And huge fans of that.
Yeah, it kind of feels like it gets in the way of the real story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that conversation that we had is what led to their conversation yesterday about, you know, we don't know what people know about this world because we talk right. about it, but we don't necessarily take the time to write it. So
it's totally.
All,
yeah.
It's all important. Yeah. So as an author and artist combo, we got to talk a little bit about how that has affected your fantasy novel writing, but are there any other ways that you have seen your background in visual arts influence your approach to writing fantasy? And I just want to throw out there, if you guys have not seen the cover of this book, definitely pop over to the show notes because it is stunning.
Thank you. I don't remember whether I said this last time. How I paint has really affected how I write, and it's maddening. painting feels like discovery. I do some sketches, but to take away the exploration and discovery that happens in painting by mapping it all out in advance makes it really difficult for me to paint. And so I usually have an idea, but a lot of my paintings have lots of layers and lots of changed parts. And and so they take a long time and they look a lot different oftentimes than what they started out with. But I like that process and it excites me. The final image excites me. And so it's the same with writing where I told you I'd mapped out the second book.
Yeah.
And it worked this way with the first one too. I'd mapped it out, but man, there's all kinds of, I want to see where this takes me that happens in between. And that just really slows down the process because like I'll be writing along, getting to this goal, say the midpoint where I want this interaction to happen between these two characters. And then I'm on the way and then something comes up and suddenly I've got to go over here. And I feel like, I feel like my plans are just thrown out the window. And so I think instead of trying to kill that impulse, I've really tried to, I'm still in the middle of it, clearly, trying to figure out how to best bridle it, I guess, or use that to make the story better. But it's like, I use the word maddening because it feels sometimes like I'm just along for the ride and, and how did we get here? And how am I even
going
to get
horses are going? In
or like on a boat in rapids or something. And so, what was the question? How does that inform how I write? I guess I've learned to be open to that happening and not to be upset or dismissive of those storylines that kind of pop up. That if I was just trying to go according to this mapped out plan, that I would immediately dismiss because I'm like, well, that's not according to the plan.
Right.
But if I embrace it or am willing to say, okay, maybe not this, but is there a version of this that could work? I think that happened enough in the first book and it turned out that it's not, I don't view it as a huge weakness other than really slowing me down. So, I mean, it does feel like it's wrestling, what I had assumed I'd just be able to control. So when I say discovery, it's like, I'm digging and I'm finding this thing. I'm discovering it as I go. And I knew it was a dinosaur. I didn't know it was going to be this big. And I didn't know it was going to be a carnivore instead of a herbivore. I don't know. Like there's understanding and then there's a surprise as well, I guess, along the way.
Yeah.
So
I like that. Fantasy literature often explores universal themes and complex characters. And so personally, I really appreciated that your book has these characters that are referred to as storm orphans. So there's big storms that happen in Hibaria and people who are out at sea. Sometimes your whole family doesn't make it or other things have happened that have created these storm orphans. And I appreciate the fact that these kids probably have PTSD and anxiety and trust issues, and you write them as if they have PTSD and anxiety and trust issues. And so even starting back with your short stories in The Awakening, I really have appreciated you tackling characters who have mental health challenges that they're going through, and that you write about them in a very realistic and relatable way. So is that you, like, so what is your process for doing that?
Yeah.
Do you do research on any of these things? Are you just writing from, you mentioned previously that, you know, in a past life, decades ago, you were a pastor. So are these just, you know, life experience of humaning with other humans or how's that look for you?
So I didn't have, I wouldn't consider what I had as a child trauma. And so it's not life experience in that sense, and that I had some horrible things happen. And I'm trying to process them, but I did have questions, and as long as I can remember, I've been very aware of how unsatisfying answers can be. And that's in general. But I think growing up in the church, it can be specific to the church too, where if you ask just really basic questions like why do bad things happen or stuff that kids run into, I think processing death when you're a kid or sickness or just general unpleasant things, and if the answer is not really an answer. If it's just trust God, which I agree with, I need to trust God. But if in that there's some dismissiveness or what I now see as maybe an inability to answer or a fear to answer because the answer is maybe too hard for the kid to understand.
That's
kind of where I've come to now. Like, man, I'm really dissatisfied with how we answer some of these questions with kids. And so really what those stories what I wanted to at least in part address was those stories with answers that maybe aren't satisfactory, but are real answers. And so I have these characters of the constellations who are authorities. Maybe they're God. Maybe they play the role of God in, as I think about this, and the kid is maybe me, or any other kid, where they ask questions, and instead of getting those really kind of glib answer, glib's probably not the right word, but just the not satisfying. Yeah, the platitudes that a kid can see through. And maybe they can't articulate why, but they're left with a feeling of I guess I can't ask that question, or I guess the real answer I'm not trusted with, or I don't know. I mean, there's a host of responses, I think, that can come from that. And I hate that. I hate that because especially coming from the point of view of someone in the church, why should we be scared of the answer? Why, if we don't believe the answer, then why do we believe it all? And so I think there's often the fear of it not being satisfying. The part of the adult when they make that choice to say, hey, your dad died and it's really terrible and I don't understand why, and it's going to take you a long time to process that. That's terrifying in the adult's mind. And so they say, everything happens for a reason and it's going to be okay. And while that's true, it's also dismissive and it doesn't meet the kid where they are, which is in emotional pain.
I feel it's a way that people don't step into suffering with others.
Whether that's a choice because suffering is scary, or whether it's a choice because they really don't believe that suffering is right. Maybe suffering is evidence of sin. I don't know. I mean, there's so many different theological places where people are coming from. And I don't believe that's true. I think to address that in an honest way, even if it's not satisfying, is what I wanted and what I want to give to people out there. And so I've often wondered, like, are these two are these stories, the in the awakening in particular, are they too psychological in the sense that does it feel like therapy? And maybe they are.
In such a good way, though. Like, I mentioned,
but does it turn people off? Like, no, that's the question.
I don't think it turns the right people off. I think the people that have been looking for answers and are wrestling with them, I think it's a banquet table almost. It's like, here, come and have the hard questions. Come and look at the fact that, like, I will tell you, this is not going to be easy, or this is going to be very hard, and this is going to be very long. When my dad passed away, some brothers came over that were friends with my sisters, and it was the next morning. They came over the next morning, and I was standing behind my sister when one of the brothers was hugging her, and their dad had passed 2 years earlier. And I heard him say to her, "It is not going to get easier. It is just going to get further away." And that was like, I needed that. Like, that was so profound. And I've seen that be so true in my life, like with miscarriages, with losing my grandparents, with losing my dad. Like, the pain itself doesn't get easier to handle when it comes up. It just gets further away. And so maybe, like, we see it less often, like it visits less often, but it still is the same pain when it comes back. And just knowing I wasn't broken and there wasn't something wrong, that was how the experience was so valuable.
Yeah. If you're told it's going to be fine, and then 6 months later, it's not fine, whatever fine is supposed to mean, like, I am broken. There is something wrong that needs to be fixed. And all of your energy is expended towards fighting grief, which is like, no, that, I mean, it's such a disservice. Not only is it, like, not true, there is damage inflicted, I think, by poorly dealing with real life.
Yeah. I think the church really on a whole in the US and the West has suffered from losing its ability to lament. Like, we just, we don't have a concept of that. Our church is getting ready to go through how to lament. Like, that's just like, that's something they've recognized is, you know, we're weak in this and we need to talk about it. There's a whole book in the Bible called Lamentations. Like, it is supposed to be part of our understanding of being human, that it is okay to lament and it is necessary to, in order to process through a whole bunch of these experiences that we will go through.
Yeah, so we're really selling the book here. It's really sad and hard.
No, it's not. It's not, but it's also not easy. Like, I wouldn't say if you're looking for a cheerful beach read for someone who is tired of heavy, sad thoughts, don't give them this book. But if you're looking, like, if you're looking for a book that will help your kid to see that they aren't alone in their suffering or their struggles, and will help them see that community can still be built after loss, which I think is a huge thing that people can really feel lost in when they lose someone, is like, I've lost that connection. Like, when my grandma died, it was really hard because I was like, here's the person who has loved me the most in my life and she's gone. Like, she's not in the world. Right. And that's this huge loss, but the Lord will still bring people who love you into your life, and it will look different than it did before, but that doesn't mean it won't still be good. And so just being able to see that for Cora, who at the beginning when you said someone who makes friends, I wanted to be like, yeah, and somebody who really resists making friends.
Sure,
like,
sure.
We should probably bridge
The Awakening is these short stories, but a lot of those themes carry over into the novel of Master of Tides. And a few of those characters are in there as well. But Cora, a new character, I mean, the book opens where you find out her parents have died and her sister as well. And she's really processing that loss. And she's processing
and doesn't
not
wanna just... doesn't want to let people in.
Doesn't want to let people in. But, like, it's... hopefully, it's you perceive it as more nuanced than... She doesn't want to forget them, but she also doesn't want to remember them. There's this conflict of whenever I remember them, it brings up the pain again.
Right.
And oftentimes I think we try to even paint it more simply than that, where it's just like, I don't want to forget them. But when you introduce this thing that's in contradiction to itself, I don't want to forget them, but I don't want to remember them.
Yeah.
To admit that, if that's you, like, that's, some people think that sounds horrible. Like, I don't want to remember my parents. Oh, you shouldn't feel like that. But, like, the truth is you don't. Like, you're in that position where, like, you have all these conflicting feelings that maybe if you voice it out loud, people are going to respond and say, like, that's terrible. But, like, that is true. That is kind of what we go through. And so, so we open with her, and I would say it's not all that. There's a lot of adventure and lightheartedness as well. But that is an underlying current that is present throughout the book that I don't want to sweep under the rug. I don't want to pretend it didn't happen at all, but I do want to deal with it in a way that I think is maybe more healthy. Hopefully,
I think it's so often we see books where this huge trauma happens, and even movies, a huge trauma will happen and everybody just, like, moves on all happy-go-lucky.
Or there's there's a 5-minute segment where they're all fixed.
Yes. The kids and I talk often about Star Wars, A New Hope, where Luke is like, I can't go. I have all these responsibilities. I have my aunt and uncle who have raised me. And then he goes back and they're, like, burned to a crisp. And he's like, bummer. Yes. No, I will go on this adventure with you.
Yeah.
And it's like, come on, Luke.
Pretty amazing.
Like,
yeah.
And there's never any reference back to it at all. And so it's like, where did we process this? So I always say that to my girls when they, like, write big traumas into their books as they're reading it to me. And it gets to that point, I'm like, please tell me that we're going to therapy after this. And they're like, oh, yeah, sure, Mom. There's therapists everywhere for this. I'm like, okay, but we have to like acknowledge that this is a really big thing that this 13-year-old character just went through, and they need time to process it.
So, No, that's, I've waded into that, and I think having not gone through it myself, there is sometimes worry's too strong, but just concern that I'm not handling it in a realistic way, or again, I think experience would be helpful. Maybe. And so I am aware of that, and I try to be mindful in that. My wife is a social worker, and so she's a reference. And then I have a couple friends who are counselors who I will talk to as well. And then friends with kids, you know, I mean, there's a lot of resources out there. And so even though I haven't gone through that, I try to be mindful by talking to people in different situations who have, to lend it, realism, I guess, or, or some level of credibility.
But. Yeah. I talk about a theology of suffering on here a lot, and how I believe that it's so important to have it before you need it with your kids. And that a lot of times we shy away from it because we're like, our kids haven't been exposed to this level of loss, or they haven't had these experiences, and I don't want to take their innocence. And I think that there's definite wisdom in not taking your children's innocence. And I think that protecting kids is, I want to believe that at this point in the podcast and in my time with RA, if anyone's hearing me talk, they understand that I'm not talking about not guarding our children's hearts and minds. But I think that there's also a huge foot up that farm kids have over city kids on watching the circle of life happen with their farm animals, and seeing life and death on that smaller scale before it becomes their grandparent or their parent or their sibling. And I think that giving it to kids in bite-sized pieces, there's a book called Phoebe's Chickens that I really like, where a fox gets Phoebe's chicken, and her dad just like sits her on his knee, and they talk through the process, and they're together, right? She's not alone trying to process this. And so I think that reading stories like that can be really helpful for kids in a before they need it sort of aspect of them, seeing somebody else walk through the situation and experience it, to be able to, you know, be that one step removed. I think that's, there's, you know, been wonderful essays written about why Lewis used anthropomorphized animals for a lot of the Chronicles of Narnia, that it's easier when it's happening to a beast instead of to you and to another human. And so there's all of that, but I've had people reach out recently and ask me if I could just talk more on the concept of a theology of suffering. And I wish I could, but I am currently in a dark night of the soul, and I am grateful that I even had the mental capacity to have this lovely conversation with you today. But I've been reading a book on this, and when I've been getting those emails of people asking me if I could talk more, I've just been sending this book recommendation and saying, this author is really saying a lot of what I believe, and she's a gifted writer. And so coherently, if you want to hear some of my thoughts, you can hear them through Kristen LaValle. And her book is called Even If He Doesn't, What We Believe About God When Life Doesn't Make Sense. And I just highly recommend that book, and it'll be in the show notes. But I think that it also talks a lot about coming into people suffering with them. And I appreciate that a lot in The Master of Tides. I love how Will inserts himself into Cora's life. And I've had that in my life many a time where I have not had an open heart and not had an open willingness to take on more relationships. And people have just shown up and inserted themselves where they saw a need and developed a friendship with me, and then just been such a blessing as they are willing to step into suffering. I had someone in Reshelving Alexandria, who after our house fire just started texting me a meme every day. And it took about 2 weeks for it to really register that she was doing this every day, because I was just in such a fog. But every day I was just having this point of being able to chuckle about something as this funny meme would come. And then it moved over to her sharing little self-deprecating stories about her day because she's hysterical. And after like a month, I was like, I think we became friends somewhere in the last month. And like, I was not looking for it, but she saw a need in my life.
A real gift. Yeah.
And she we call it penguin pebbling, because penguins will just like come and put a new pebble in someone's nest that they like. It's like, so every day I got a new pebble in my message box. And
awesome.
So I encourage people to do that, to like step into suffering with others. And I think the reward is great, because that was 4 years ago now, and the story has flipped, and I've been able to step into suffering with her during that time as well. And I think that those relationships can be so beautiful, and we may not even be looking for them, but to just be open to them as Cora's heart finally opens to Will, who's just a sweetheart and good comedic relief in this story. So you're writing book two, and how are you managing your time between your two passions of writing and artwork, Jamin? How's that going for you?
Well, and throw in the wrinkle that we have three kids. Me and my wife have three kids, and I don't know how I forget that every winter is just like sickness time.
Yeah, the plague.
And so I'm always excited about the winter for all this time I'll get to write. And it seems like every time it's like, surprise. And this year has been especially difficult in that up until a couple of weeks ago, one of us in the house had been sick since November, since Thanksgiving. And you know, our oldest got a fever this weekend, so we're kind of right back in it. With that said, you got to find the time when you can. And I have been writing and painting, just way less than I want to. And so,
But instead you're living life experience of suffering, right?
Yeah.
Stepping into
giving
their
me more material,
yeah.
Put a positive spin on it. So it's been hard. The light at the end of the tunnel is, and I don't want to say this because our daughter is four. She is, doing pre-K right now, 5 days a week, but just in the morning. And so I'm watching her three afternoons and obviously not working during that time. We are painting though. I will say as an aside, she's an artist now. She often tells, she's like, we're the artists. And I'm like,
yeah.
And so that's great time. I'm not going to complain about that at all. But to the point of your question, that means I'm not working during that time. And so she does start school in the fall, and obviously I feel conflicted about that. I'm sad to see her go, but excited to get some time back. And so that's one of those things where I feel bad about feeling excited, but that's just how things go. So all that to say, the light at the end of the tunnel is I'll have more time starting in the summer, so I can dedicate it more to work.
That's great.
So, but it is hard
to
balance. I don't know if that's what you're getting at with the question of painting and writing. I think I try to do, I can't do more than, I think, 4 hours of each at a time. Those muscles get pretty stiff after that amount of time. So on a good day, I will write in the morning, paint in the afternoon, and that's ideal. If for some reason I can't write in the morning, I'll bump it to the afternoon. But like if I get suddenly a whole day, I can't make up writing from the previous day lost. Like I can't do 8 hours. It doesn't quite work like that. So I've got some weird constraints just based on who I am and how I work. But that's kind of where I'm at.
Everybody's process is definitely different. Which is why we ask, because it helps people to know that whatever their process is not.
It's not wrong.
It's just yours. There's no wrong answer to this question.
Mm-hmm.
So, So can you give us a sneak peek or teaser for what we can expect in the next installment of the series?
Well, it picks up a couple weeks after the first one left off, which I won't spoil how that one ends, but it does pick right up. And there is, I think it's pretty exciting because it, we get some more characters from Awakening. I think I can say this, there's only out of the maybe 16 or so characters in the Awakening, because some of the stories are one kid and some mm-hmm. stories are a pair of kids. Out of those 16, I was only able to bring in three to the first story, which it's not a great start. If you're an author and you're trying to figure out a way to introduce these characters, you're like, this is going to be an 8-book series, you know? But no, I think how I've been thinking about it is it's more natural at this point to bring in more of those. And so you do see several more characters come in. I'm excited about those characters and how they can interact with Korra. And I haven't seen them for years. Yeah. I haven't thought about them really in the way that I thought about them when I was writing them for years. And so after going through, like, working on this chunk of the story, this being book one, then stepping beyond it, it's like, fresh vistas open up in front of me and fresh storylines that I think I know. And so there will be, I don't know how to, like, talk about what I'm writing without spoiling it,
but that's exciting that we're going to get to see more characters from the Awakening.
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
is good to know.
And the story is advancing. Yeah.
That's good. Good. My kids tease me because I'm terrible with names and faces in real life and I'm just as bad in books. And so I usually just refer to people by, like, some event that they were about. And so the kids were talking about how they were hoping more characters from the Awakening would come, and they of course know everyone by name, so that means nothing to me, and I'm just like, I just want the hot air balloon girl to show up. That's who I'm rooting for.
Sarah.
Yeah. I want more Sarah. So
no, so they're coming, and actually as I was struggling with the problem of how to bring in more characters sooner without it being obvious that I just want more characters, like,
right.
Yeah. It's really tricky. When I wrote The Awakening, I didn't realize I was in some ways writing myself into a corner, in that I was laying things out, laying questions out that had to be answered, characters out that had to be introduced. And it's both good and bad. It's hard when you feel like you have to shoehorn them in. That's just not good. That's just not great for a story if you're like, oh, and here's Sarah, because she has to be, right? Uh-huh. I mean, there has to be a reason. And so the bad part is if I feel like I am shoehorning them in, but then the good part is, like, come on, man, you're creative. You can figure out a way to make this work. And what I've settled on, I think, is pretty exciting. And it's fairly early on in the story that allows me to very naturally introduce more of those. And so that has to do with Sophie. Sophie is the blind girl in one of the stories. And so to be able to introduce her, and then how I use her to introduce the others is pretty awesome. Pretty exciting.
That sounds awesome. We do have a reader question to wrap up with, which was, why did you choose a female heroine, and has that created any challenges as a male author?
Well, I'm not a girl, so that is obviously a challenge. man, this is such a good question, and one I get a lot. You would think I'd have a ready answer for. And this is probably very unsatisfying. I just wanted to, and I've always been more interested in female protagonists than male, and I don't know why. It's really like, no, just because I felt like it, but it kind of is. Like, I was drawn to that character, and I don't, not just that character, but a female character. And I don't know whether that is, it could be a couple things. Oftentimes people have said, I connect, and I've known this through personal experience, that I connect more with women in conversation. And I don't know whether it's because I'm more interested in those conversation topics. Well, I mean, talking about suffering, mm-hmm. it's more kind of feelingsy. I know it's not just feelings, but like,
right.
it's more inner life.
Yeah.
Thoughts and conversations that interest me. And to be honest, a lot of dudes don't just like to talk about that. You know, like there are some, yeah. and I have a lot of friends mm-hmm. who are guys who I do. But I think that has maybe steered me more in that direction because typically, again, not all the time, but typically females like to talk about that and think about that more. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways it kind of comes out of, me being interested in that, and it makes sense that it's a girl. Mm-hmm. Obviously I'm a guy. I could have written a guy. So I think that was one of the reasons. I think too, like I've got a daughter who, mm-hmm. Is 4 and I love her to death and I want to write a girl heroine for her, you know? Yeah. And so I don't know. I guess that's a reason too. Yeah. There's a lot of books out there with guys. I think there's some with girls too, but they don't spring to mind as readily as all the guy heroes. And so mm-hmm. it's a very self-centered reason too. It's like, yeah, it's for my kid, you know? So I don't know. Those are two possibilities for answering that. But really, I don't know. It's like, I kind of felt like it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the knee-jerk initial response. And yes, it is challenging because it's like, oftentimes I will consult with my wife or with other women to say, is this a thing? Is this like, mm-hmm. am I missing something here? And obviously I'm not going to get everything right, or women are subjective too. And so they might say, no, that's not a thing, but like maybe mm-hmm. it is for a different woman.
Right.
And so I hope that it isn't like, hey, this is just a guy clearly that is a girl in your story. Like you don't know what you're doing. Hopefully it's not that. And I haven't heard that yet. So if I do, well, I'll deal with
that. I haven't heard it. I've read your reviews. I haven't heard it.
Okay. You have. I haven't. Cool. Good, good.
No. Nobody said it. So I thought Cora was a very realistic teen girl. So she seemed like someone that my girls would hang out with.
Cool. So well, that's great to hear. Yeah. Good deal. Yeah.
Well, awesome. So Jamin's book, The Master of Tides, is available now, and it's available on Amazon and through Living Book Press under Renewed Books, and you can find it there, and it will be linked in our show notes, and the audiobook is available on Audible. Is it available anywhere else, or is it just on Audible?
Yeah, so I'm in the process of I went through, I think it's called Authors Republic, which I create a profile and upload the files, and it will be available through like 50 different channels. And
okay,
so
sweet.
I think about half of those are live now. So mm-hmm. it's on the obvious
so
ones, like
poke around and you'll find it.
Yeah. Like if you have like a favorite audio mm-hmm. channel that you've kind of committed to, chances are it's gonna pop up on one of those pretty soon. So
yeah, and the other thing that you guys can be doing is asking your library to order the book. That is a very helpful way to get it in front of multiple eyes, including your own. So all of those links will be in our show notes, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come and hang out with us, Jamin.
Well, and I would add the reviews thing, even though I don't read them, reviews are mm-hmm. hugely important for other people seeing the book.
Yeah. The different platforms won't show it to people will show it to more people when there's a certain number of reviews. So,
right. And so
just writing that you read it and the cover was beautiful. That counts.
That's enough. And I know that's an extra step that I oftentimes, it's not natural for me to like, I'm going to go out and write a review. So I do recognize there's some extra energy expended in doing that, but just know that it's not wasted at all. It's mm-hmm. it's disproportionately helpful to the amount of work that you end up putting into to do that. So if you did like it, or even if Amber says you just like the cover,
Yeah.
Write a review. That'd be great.
That's awesome. Well, you guys can find our show notes on reshelvingalexandria.com. And remember, the stories are truer than true.